talking about skin color, hair color, or, you know, anything that had to do with grooming, it never occurred to me to acknowledge that they had different coloring than I did. You know, I look back and laugh about that. But then the second year, then I decided that I wanted a different kind of teaching experience. And I had, again, as a beginning teacher, I was assigned a very good assignment, actually, for a beginning teacher because of my high grades at Purdue. And then I asked to be transferred to a different school the second year. That would be closer to, we had bought a little house that would be closer to our house. And so the second year, I actually taught in a brand new high school, and I set up the whole department of home economics in my second year of teaching. And then I had a second child, and at that time in our history, women did not wear maternity clothes in the classroom. So fortunately, school was out in June, and my youngster was born in October, so it worked out just right. But then, after that, I did some very interesting things in education, and I taught some night school classes for adults. I taught, did a little bit of substitute, but that didn't really work for me because I didn't have a babysitter on tap all the time. Night school, my husband could take care of them. But then I realized that I wanted something more structured and more challenging, so I called my home economics supervisor that I had worked with my first year, and I told her that I felt I had 2 hours a day that I could teach. Was there anything that I could do? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, they were setting up a brand new program to train women on welfare to be domestic workers. And if I would like to do that, I would have to write all my own material. I would have to do everything. And it would be held at this school downtown that was left, remained standing after they took down all the slums around it and put the highways in. And so I said, well, sure, I'll do that, you know. So I was able to work it out with my little ones of organizing that. And so I would teach 2 hours a day, and my class members were all women on welfare. And the class would last for 4 weeks. It would be 2 hours a day for 4 weeks. And they were either African American or Kentucky hillbillies. Mm-hmm. And I guess we call those rednecks. But anyway, it was an interesting combination of people. And I probably got the best education of my life during the years that I did that. So the next year, I changed the hours that would match my personal needs. Mm-hmm. And again, it was 2 hours a day. And I learned so much about, I was so naive when I started, I didn't realize they didn't know how to read or write. And I assumed that when I described making a bed, they were getting the mental picture that I was getting when I described making a bed, not realizing that, no, that wasn't the case. And so I learned during that teaching experience to break ideas down to the simplest components. And it was a valuable, valuable lesson. I really learned how to communicate. I realized that just because I was speaking didn't mean that people were listening or understanding. They were listening, but they weren't understanding what I was describing. So then when I realized that many of them couldn't read or write, then a literacy class was set up for them. Then they would come into my class. And then the welfare department would find them jobs. So it was a very successful program. And I... in the third year, actually added an hour to it so that I could teach something about simple food preparation and more things than we could cover in the
class. Was this a restaurant-type job?
No, just working domestic? In the home. Yeah. Mm-hmm, domestic. And some worked in hospitals, mm-hmm. but as cleaning people in hospitals. But what I tried to do was instill pride in them and give them little tips that would make them better than anyone else. They were our secrets, and all the things that I could do to make them feel better about the kind of job they were going to have. And so it was very successful, and this was before the government was involved in training programs, so the Department of Labor sent people out to observe this because it was working so well, and they were getting ready to put me on closed-circuit television so that I could teach to lots of people. But then my husband took a new job in Indianapolis, and so they actually disbanded the classes because by then there was government money available if you were starting new classes. but not.
What year was that?
That was 63, 64, along in there. Mm-hmm. And so when we moved to Indianapolis, I knew that I didn't want to teach in a classroom setting anymore because I had learned about myself that I love to give up, gather up information, but I only want to give it out once. Pretty difficult to do when you're teaching. And so,
I understand.
Yes. So then I discovered I thought I had died and gone to heaven. I discovered broadcasting. And it's very much like teaching. You gather up the information, but you can only give it out once. And it fit me perfectly. And I found this quite by accident. Again, it was through this home ec group that I mentioned earlier, where a woman in the group said that she was moving out of town and she needed to replace herself in this job. And it was working for a PR firm based in New York who had one home economist per major market. So in the case of Indiana, they had one home economist, period, in the state of Indiana. And my job was to represent clients in whatever way they had given me instructions. So it might be to create some stories in the newspapers. It might be to appear on radio shows or television shows to talk about products or services. So I discovered that broadcasting fit me perfectly.
Now, was this when you were public relations representative for InfoPlan?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's the one down here at the bottom. And it was something that I did easily and enjoyed. And because I was always curious about everything, I had quite a filing cabinet of things that I clipped and saved. So I became quite the person in demand on these talk shows to come in, and at the last minute they would call, a guest hadn't shown up, Lorene, jump in your car and come over and do a radio show, just pull something out of your files, you know. And so it was a lot of fun. It was a great experience for me, and I learned really how to do that on the air, and ended up having then a daily radio show and
on WXLW,
uh-huh.
Which is an Indianapolis station, is that right?
Mm-hmm. And
you know, your daily radio show was the subject of some economics?
No, it was sponsored by a shopping center, and I would interview people at stores and talk to them about products and shopping and that kind of thing. So it was promotion for the shopping center.
Which shopping center?
Southern Plaza Shopping Center here in Indianapolis. And at the same time, I was also doing some television things for clients, and then eventually would be asked if I would do a commercial for a company, and you know, just sort of gradually moved into these things. And then I was 1 year at the Indiana State Fair. They had a real problem in that the woman that was the director for the women's building had some personal problems and wasn't going to be able to, they found out in May, wasn't going to be able to do her job through mm-hmm. September, a critical time. And my younger brother had been president of the State Fair Board, and they knew me and so asked me to fill in. And as a result of that, I met a lot more people in the media, had to do a lot of media things for all the changes we were making in the women's building at that time. And so when this then was asked to be on the noon news at Channel 13. And
SWTHR.
Right. And at that time, they were where Channel 20 is now. And so actually, the noon news that I was on, my claim to fame is that David Letterman was the weatherman on the noon news.
Is that right?
But I did a taped segment. When they asked me to do this, they actually wanted me to be on the air every day. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that just didn't work for me. I didn't want my life to revolve around where I had to be every day at noon, how my hair looked, and what I was going to wear. Mm-hmm. And so they said, well, what would you be willing to do? And I said, well, I would be willing to tape my segments. So I was like the original Martha Stewart, because what I did on television was what I figured other women would be interested in knowing about and doing. And because I sewed and I created things and I kept my own house and I decorated and I cooked and all of these things, so the shows that I did would be things that, that women could relate to because they were doing them too. And I would show them how to make a man's tie or, you know, whatever it was that was kind of the in thing. And so it was a great experience. And I also then ended up at the same time having a syndicated radio show. I found that I did know how to write this kind of thing, having learned how to be very concise from my early teaching experiences. And so I wrote and taped 200 one-minute radio shows and as my own business and sold them into sponsors.
It's the same general subject.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is subject of interest to women?
Or anyone. I visualized a man driving along in his car listening to the radio that he would just be as interested in what I was saying as a woman would be. So it might be how to sew a button on so it won't fall off. You know, very simple, fun kinds of things that anyone could relate to and say, oh, that's a good idea.
So you kept drawing on your home economics background as you expanded your career in different directions.
Yes. And I think I'm a real example of how you take a basic education and parlay it into just about anything that you decide you want to do.
Well, there have been pretty dramatic changes in the role of women in American society in the time that you grew up and developed your career and so on. How did you see your life changing as society around you began to rethink the role of women?
Well, I was always on the cutting edge of everything. I was doing things before other women did them and finding ways to combine my traditional role with my avant-garde position of moving forward. When I was doing this radio and television, you know, I had an office at home and I did all the traditional wife-mother things, and I called myself a closet career woman, but the only thing was people saw me on television, you know, but then they also saw me at my son's little league game in the afternoon. So I tried to combine all of it, and but I was able to do that by having, you know, operating from my home so that I might be talking on the phone while I was taking the clothes out of the dryer kind of thing. Well, you, no, I couldn't do that because we didn't have cell phones, you know, or answering machines or faxes or anything.
I believed you. I thought you just had a long cord. So.
Well, yes. But, and then I was, you know, with a father like I had, there was never any limit in my mind as to what I might do. And I was very fortunate that I had teachers, even in these little schools, where I wasn't really well prepared as far as subject matter to go to college. I had no chemistry, no physics, no advanced math. I mean, I was really very unprepared in subject matter to go to college. Never had written a theme. And my teacher said, well, Lorene, you can do anything that you want to do. You may have to work harder, because you won't have the background that some of the young people will have, but you can do it. All you have to do is have somebody tell you you can do it that you believe in, and you do it. And I knew that I would have to work hard in chemistry. Why wouldn't I? I had no idea what it was about. But I ended up making better grades than the kids that went to college prep schools who had maybe a whole year of chemistry in high school, because I knew that I knew nothing and I really had to work. And they thought they knew something and didn't have to work as hard, and they found out, you know, that it was a little harder than they thought it was going to be. But it was also interesting to me that, and since I'm still very involved at Purdue, I've talked to various faculty people about this. You know, the college has become very specialized and people have very narrow focus. And I explained to them how important my broad-based education was, that when I took home economics at Purdue, it was a really tough course. At Purdue, we had to have 140 hours to graduate, and we graduated in 4 years. No one ever thought of going to summer school or staying longer than 4 years. So we carried 18, 19 hours a semester. And we had to take physics, a year of inorganic chemistry, a semester of organic chemistry. We had to take biology. We had to take economics. All these things that I was like, but I just want to be a home ec teacher. Oh, no, this is what you take here. And that was so valuable to me because we never know what we're going to do in our lives. And when I became the Director of Consumer Services at Jan Air Corporation, I went back somewhere in my brain to that science-based education because I wrote the original consumer literature for convection cooking. And you had to know about air movement and temperatures and all that kind of thing. And I conducted all the research there for it. And so, I really believe in a very broad-based of taking subjects that you think have no relevance to your life and forcing yourself to learn as much as you can because you never know what's going to happen. And when you need it, you don't have time to learn it.
I'm going to ask you a question that I hope is relevant because somebody is going to listen to this tape or read this transcript and ask themselves, what in the world is convection cooking?
Convection. Okay. Convection cooking had always been used in commercial ovens. And that's why when you would go to a restaurant and have a standing rib roast, the meat was so crispy on the outside and juicy on the inside. Well, in convection cooking, there's a fan that blows the hot air around the food. Where in radiant baking, which is a traditional oven, the heat element is just on the top. There's a heat element on the top that you use for broil, and then the heat element is on the bottom. So all the heat is on the bottom of the oven. And so what they do is take that heat that's on the bottom, put a fan in the back of the oven, and on today's convection ovens, all you do is just flip it over to convection, and you hear the fan come on. Mm-hmm. Well, it then makes the food cook faster, but it also makes, for roasting meat, it makes it crispy outside, but make a very juicy interior, so that the inside isn't overcooked while you're getting it crispy outside.
So you helped to develop that technology?
No, I wrote the consumer materials on what it is and how you use it in the home. Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to ask you a few questions about your career, which seems to be like, if I could imagine it in my mind, it would be like a braided rope. I mean, everything
yes.
seems to be twisted together, but we talk a little bit about your involvement in radio and television, but I noted on your resume that between 1972 and 78, you were director of consumer services for two companies, Reuben Montgomery and Associates and Jen Air.
Mm-hmm.
Could you first tell me what those companies were
yes.
and then briefly describe what you did?
Yes. for people with a degree in home economics, the position that was open in the business world that became a position in the 60s was consumer services. And if you remember when consumerism became a big topic in the late 60s, early 70s, then companies found they needed to have a person who was director of consumer services, which meant that they were the contact with the customer when they called in and had a complaint or needed information. That's what that person did. Well, then a person with a degree in home economics was the logical person to fill that position. And so when I was director of consumer services at Reuben Montgomery, this was an advertising agency. And so what I did was to use my background in communications and radio and television and in writing and applied it to their customers, their clients that they did advertising for. So I was actually the spokesperson for different clients, and I would write, like for American Red Bull Moving Company, I would write their brochures. But for their clients, I would do specialized things, and my name would be on them, Home Economist Lorene Chuck, which would gave it some status and said that this is a person who has a degree, you know, is supposed to know something that's important for people to know. So I was there for 3 years, and then was offered this position at Jan Air Corporation, which was a manufacturer of an electric grill. Mm-hmm. And I had met Mr. Jin, again, through a contact through this home economics group that I became involved with. And whenever he needed a freelance home economist, he would call me to demonstrate the product here and there. And this electric grill was a new concept, where what made it work was that he had created something called downdraft ventilation. So you turn on your electric grill, but then there's a vent. Instead of being on the ceiling above you, it was at the same level as where you were cooking. And then the smoke would be pulled down, and then it would be vented to the outside. So I used to laugh and say, you know, we've all been taught that smoke goes up. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to prove to you right now, when I turn this on, that smoke can go down. And so as I was their first director of consumer services, and this was at a time when he was beginning to develop other products.
So this was incorporated into a stove?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it was a separate unit. Okay. You could buy just the grill. Yes, but today, I don't know whether they sell just the grill by itself, but it's actually incorporated in a Jin Air cooktop. Mm-hmm. So he was beginning, Mr. Jin was beginning to develop additional consumer products, so he felt that he needed someone full-time, and he was going to be building an actual facility for having groups come in and having programs and having a big kitchen built for doing testing. And so he asked me to be their first director of consumer services. But I also traveled all over the country representing Jin Air and speaking to their distributors mm-hmm. and builders. And then I would go back to using my broadcasting background. Mm-hmm. So I would have interviews with media people, and I'd be on radio and television to talk about Jin Air and grilling. And
so you became the spokesperson for the product?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then 1978 to 83, you worked for Borden Incorporated, mm-hmm. director of new product development. What did you do in that capacity?
Well, this was very interesting. That was the first job that I had where having a degree in home economics had nothing to do with the job. So it was a major leap forward for me. And this was at a time when women were beginning to enter the middle level of management, and they were beginning to have their own companies. So it was a time that was very exciting, and women were trying, you know, there was a lot of unrest, and feminism became a big thing, and women were beginning to say, well, we have these college degrees, we're capable of doing these things, we want to work, and we want jobs that have some meaning to them. Well, I was very fortunate with each job that I had, was that the person who wanted me to take the job came to me and asked me to take it. I wasn't out looking for other jobs. And I had been divorced after 20 years of marriage, and so I was offered this job with Borden and would be based in Houston, Texas, so it meant moving from Indianapolis to Houston. And so it was a good time in my life to do that. My oldest son was in college, the other one was in high school, and so I took this position. I was the only woman executive in 10,000 employees, but then I had been the only woman executive every place that I had been. And so that was just, and with bigger numbers, but it didn't feel like it, because in our office in Houston there were only 20 executives. Now, they were all the top executives mm-hmm. of the company, but I was the only woman, but I was only, you know, there were just 20 of us there. And we all traveled, and it was pretty exhilarating, because everyone there had the ability to say yes. Mm-hmm. That's very important to know in business, because if you're only dealing with the people that have the authority to say no, you're not in the management level. So anyway, as director, I was their first director of new product developments in the dairy division at Borden, which was a very large company. The dairy division of Borden was about $1 billion business, I think, and it was, of course, all over the United States, everybody's familiar with Borden milk and Elsie the cow. And I used to laugh and say Elsie and I were the two females in the company. But so I had to figure out the job. So that also became a part of my life, of because no one had ever had the positions before I had them, and every job I'd had, except my first teaching position, I always had to figure out what it was about, how to do it, and then do it. And so,
what did the director of new product development become?
Well, that person, I became a person who went back to my farm background, as well as what I had learned about food and nutrition at Purdue, and looking at the line of products that Borden had and saying, are there what we call line extensions? Are there products here where we can create some kind of a new product from something we already have? But then I also looked
at...
Could
you give me an example?
Well, yes, an example would be cottage cheese. Cottage cheese is very good for you. But cottage cheese was not very acceptable, it wasn't an exciting product, let's put it that way, because it was soupy. You had to spoon it out of the container and eat it with a fork. Well, this was when spooned eating out of a container was becoming very popular. Yogurt was just coming out in the container, and people loved the idea of the convenience of eating out of the container because women were working and people were busy. So that was a product that I looked at and said, I need to understand how this is made from the very beginning and what potential there might be here for doing something with that product. And so our research, the Borden Research Center was in Syracuse, New York, so my work day would be, might be to get on the plane in Houston at 7 in the morning and fly to Syracuse. Get off the plane and be picked up, taken to the research center where maybe 20 men are sitting around a table waiting for me to arrive. I would walk in, their lunch was on the table, sit down at the head of the table, and the meeting would start. And my job was to pull from these experts who had been with the company for a long time all of the information I could determine that I could use to determine what might be done with that particular product. And out of that, we created a test product that we called, well, in the testing process, cube food, because you have to have some kind of a name to put on things. So basically what we did was to take the cheese product that is made originally in the process of making cottage cheese. It's a curd. But it doesn't get soupy till you add something to it that makes it soupy, which is called a dressing. So I said, well, what does the curd taste like? Well, it doesn't really taste like anything, but it's very nutritious. Well, then why don't we make it taste like something and not add the dressing to it? So we made this into a bar, our little chunks, where we added all different kinds of fruit flavors, all different kinds of spice flavors, and it was just a fabulous product because you could eat, you know, just eat it like a candy bar. And it was just zooming along in tests and all the things that we were doing with it and finding all the applications there might be for it. And what killed the product, which often happens in large companies, is that it was such a big idea that the foods division of the company said, well, this is such a big idea, the dairy division could never do a good job of marketing this, so we're going to take that product over here where we know how to market, not understanding that it was a short shelf-life product that had to be in the dairy case. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't do business in the dairy case, so the product died. And that often happens in companies. It was very interesting. So many of the things that I worked with, You had to be a very optimistic, positive person because almost every project that I worked on never happened. Now, we learned a lot while we were doing it. It might be applied to something else. But another line extension would be just adding flavors to milk that had never been done before. But then I also looked for products all over the world and processes. So sometimes it was a process that made the product different. And so then I would be the point person. Sometimes they would be so confidential. I worked on a project in Buffalo, New York, that was so confidential that the Borden attorney had to be with me every time we had a meeting, and then all of the notes had to be kept together. They were then if the project didn't happen, all the notes had to be returned to that company. And so it was a very interesting time because I was traveling, I was by myself, I didn't have a family unit that I had grown up thinking would always be my life. So always I was plowing new ground, and of course during that period of time it was very difficult for me to be involved in any way in anything in a community. But I still was involved in the Home Economics Association.
In Texas now?
Yes, in Texas, yes. But I spoke everywhere. I spoke to women's groups all over the country. Wherever I was, I would try to get a speaking appointment set up before I went there because I wanted to help other women find their way. Mm-hmm. And I gave a speech called Seven Steps to Success. The speech was different every time I gave it because I was learning myself, you
see. So the seven steps changed?
Yes.